was looking at CIA torture programs. I was looking at front companies that had been set up to facilitate them. And for me, that was really an interesting allegory for state power.
Sometimes we present in exhibitions and we have the reviewers, they said, this is evidence, this is not art.
Yeah.
And then the people that we confronted were saying, hold on, that's art, that's not evidence.
What I try to do in my work is very simple, which is to try to see the world around us. I've been out to the deserts in the United States and photographed secret military bases. I've tracked spy satellites and photographed them with telescopes. I've gone diving into the ocean to find the internet cables that 99% of the world's communications travel through. My name is Trevor Paglen. I'm an artist and I'm from the United States.
Architecture isn't just about the design of buildings. It's also a way of seeing the world, understanding how politics becomes built form.
The crime scene as an image is a kind of...
At Forensic Architecture, we operate like architectural detectives. We use leaked data, found videos, and architectural analysis to investigate the crimes of states and corporations and to support struggles for justice. My name is Eyal Weitzman. Born in Haifa, live in London and Berlin. I write books, I make exhibitions, and I run a forensic agency.
We're living at a moment of political, economic, environmental crisis. And it's crucial that we try to learn how to see the world around us.
And grapple with some of the challenging questions about our future. How can art become operative and contribute to this moment in history?
What does it mean to be living at a moment in time when our lives and our labor is being automated in new ways? And on the other hand, that we're surrounded by sensors that are recording and collecting data about the most intimate parts of our lives.
And how do we create tools for evidence gathering and fact-finding when disinformation and fake news are rife?
Join us for Studio B Unscripted.
Trevor, I often fall upon your exhibitions when I travel. I go in, I see computer boxes, I see research, I see drone photographs of secret sites. Is this art?
Sure, yeah. So I'm an artist, and that means a lot of different things, you know, to a lot of different people. So for some people, that means something nice to have on your wall or something to invest a bunch of money into. For me, what I want out of art is quite simple. I want things that help us see the historical moment in which we're living. Mm. So for example, if I go out and I'm trying to see spy satellites in the night sky, I'm looking at the sky, and there's a tradition of thousands, if not tens of thousands of years of other artists who've looked at that same thing and have seen that through the lens of their moment in history. So you're having a conversation not only with the other people alive today, but you're having a conversation with the artist from the past, and you're saying, hey, this is what the sky or the night sky looks like. But we could also throw that back to you. I mean, your background is as an architect, but what you do is not designing buildings or things like that. So how do you situate yourself within architecture?
architecture is not only the kind of the techniques and notation for building buildings, but it's a way of understanding the world. It's a way of seeing the world. So right now, we are at a situation where, let's say, forensic architecture is asked to investigate something. We would harvest from the internet dozens and dozens of clips and images and every material. This is called open source investigation. And you need to compose them into a scene. And that scene is always spatial. So we're sitting here, this is Al Jazeera's office, Al Jazeera's studio, and a year ago, effectively, an Al Jazeera journalist had been shot dead by Israeli forces. Israel is saying, we do not know who shot her, or they're saying, in fact, it's Palestinian fighters that have shot her. And the way in which we work is we construct a three-dimensional model, hence the architecture of the forensic
architecture. And you mean quite literally a three-dimensional model?
Three-dimensional digital model in which we would place dozens and dozens of videos and photographs. And we'll navigate, we'll move between one video and the other in order to see how they add up to a scene. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see an entire scene within one frame, you see a perpetrator and a victim, and that is easy to interpret. But in most cases, you need to compose fragments, and architecture becomes a kind of like an arena or an assembly where you can place all this evidence together and start seeing things. And in that sense, the work is sometimes, you know, what other people would say, multi or interdisciplinary. And your work touches so many different fields of knowledge, and somehow through art you compose them together. And I'd like to ask you about the way in which you navigate different fields of knowledge and how you bring them together.
You know, to bring it back to this question of learning how to see, you know, different disciplines all have different ways of seeing or different things that are significant to them. For example, I've done projects looking at the structure of torture programs, for example. And you learn, okay, well, there's, you know, obviously prisons and guards and things like that, but there's front companies and there's logistics and there's a whole, you know, architecture, I guess, for lack of a better word, of a program. Now, in order to study that, you might have to use some tools from investigative journalism. You might have to use some tools from open source intelligence, as you imagine. So you put these different tools together. And what I'm looking for is a moment or a specific detail that is almost an allegory for a bigger story. So, for example, when I was looking at CIA torture programs, I was looking at front companies that had been set up to facilitate them. And I found on the corporate filings, there was, you know, a CEO who had had to sign their name on all the filings. And the signature was different on every single document because the person did not exist, right? Yeah. Because it was a fake company. Yeah. And for me, that was really a interesting allegory for state power. What is this form of power that is so violent in a way, and there's literally an invisible person behind it, or there's always an agenda behind it?
Yeah.
What kind of techniques have been useful to you in the work that you've done?
Yeah, so initially, again, I think that a very interesting hinge here is the kind of relation between a specific and general.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what art and architecture does also, no? Because when you're an architect, you can, you know, you can learn many disciplines. Finally, you have a very specific problem. You need to build a building in a particular location. For us, it's to analyze a specific instance or incident, usually, you know, what the state would call a split-second incident, no, because it has no history. It's just as if it's just that moment. And interrogate it in really minute details. So say, you know, we talked about the murder of Shirin Abu Akleh. And to ask, when you expose the fact and you show exactly where the soldier that shot her stood and what gun they used and how this whole event unfolded, is to locate it within the context, within a historical, cultural, political context of Israeli occupation or settler colonialism, and to understand that relation between the specific and the general. And that relation between, that I find really interesting, and I think that, you know, art and architecture gives us somehow the energy, the force to do that, is that you find universals sometimes within micro-specificities. But I would like to ask you, because I've seen various exhibitions by you, that the relation between the viewer and the work is more than one of simple observation and contemplation.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you that the part of the task is to create a context for seeing, right? So when I was in art school, you know, I would get critiqued because people would say, you know, you have a frame, and what's in the frame, that's the art, and what's not in the frame, that's not the art. And if you need some stuff that's outside of the frame to inform the art, then you failed. Yeah. It fails as an art object.
Yeah.
And I always completely rejected that. I was like, this is the stupidest idea, because we're always bringing something to an image. We're always bringing something to an artwork or an exhibition. Yeah. If you go and see the Mona Lisa, Jesus Christ, you have a huge amount of context about how much money it costs and, you know, the hero that Leonardo da Vinci may not have been, what have you. But where I'm arriving at is that I think when you're making art, you are also making a context to see that within, right? So you're saying, I want you to look at this image, or I want you to look at this sculpture, what have you, but this is a framework that you can look at it from. And when you look at it from that framework, you're going to see something very, very different than if you don't have that framework. Yeah. And so I think we're kind of have that in common, that we're trying to not only show something, but create a context for seeing that.
Yeah. And I think also exhibitions are events in the world. And sometimes they can be political events. And, you know, since the arts and kind of like museums have become such a part of the whole kind of economy of the spectacle, no? I mean, it's kind of like a weekend, you know, pastime for so many people, that you can subvert that. Just like we subvert the tools of art and architecture. No, I'm kind of taking architecture, turn it around and turn it into an investigative tool. An exhibition could become an event because it can focus attention on a particular topic. What is called the work you've done on tour on the...
We did a project called Autonomy Cube, which was a sculpture that's also a Wi-Fi network, but it takes all of the traffic and encrypts it all and runs it through a system that makes it very difficult to surveil.
Yeah.
And that was a project that speaks to another thing that I really want out of art, which is not simply things that are trying to see the world, but things that give you a tiny glimpse of how the world could be different.
Yeah.
Right?
And so, but it also did something, no?
I mean,
it actually allowed people to be protected for the duration of the show and do things on their private, you know, sort of smartphones.
Right.
That this traffic would not be monitored otherwise. Mm-hmm. So there is an event that is kind of being produced. And for us, this is about like bringing a topic, creating the exhibition as a moment of intervention. And, you know, to our exhibition, very often, you know, prosecutors, police would come. You know, we had the head of Chicago Police Department spending 2 hours in a piece that we've done there. You know, sometimes we're presenting in exhibitions and we have the reviewers. So when we presented in Documenta, they said, this is evidence. This is not art. So they rejected it as art. And then that same piece of work, because it got all this visibility, because it was an event, turned into event through the art world, was called into a legal framework. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the people that we confronted were saying, hold on, that's art. That's not evidence. And somehow that ambiguity is very powerful because you're not in anyone's pocket somehow.
Yeah.
And I feel that a lot of your work has done, you know, exposed things to public consciousness that people just simply not know. You know, the amazing research project that you've done on Torture Taxi, where you've produced an entire investigation simply for your capacity and attention to see and to connect things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that in a lot of the work that I do, there is a tremendous amount of research that goes into it. And ultimately, what I'm trying to arrive at is, as I describe these like nonfiction allegories or these moments that very similar to the work that you do, that try to then open up onto the world again. Sometimes you learn things that you think, well, this actually should be in the world. Like this, we should explain this process or explain the work behind it because you think it can make a contribution to the world. So how do you think about forensics? Because I think it's quite different and yet overlapping with, you know, a detective or a TV show about, you know, CSI or what have you.
So it means to me what it meant to the people that first coined the term, the sort of great orators of the first century BC. And for Quintilian and for Cicero, forensics meant the art of the forum. It didn't mean really presentation in a legal context. Mm-hmm. The forum was actually a kind of place where we present facts or things and debate our future. Mm-hmm. And I think that we want to extract forensics from, you know, the jaw of the court and to say it's only a matter for the law. And we want to take the same piece of work, put it in multiple forums, may there be media forums and cultural forums, legal forums, political forums, and in each one another facet of the work becomes somehow available. And in doing so, you can create the forensic presentation become an event in the world, become a claim, a political claim for transformation. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we should ask the audience what they kind of made out of that and see if there's any good questions that can...
So over the course of both of your careers, the digital and data landscapes have changed a huge amount. And I think we're kind of on the verge of another huge shift with the kind of explosion of artificial intelligence and the way that's changing our lives. So I was wondering how this kind of shift has changed the way that you make work up to now, and how it might be, you might see it changing going forward.
It's such a Trevor question.
No, this is completely the foundation of what you do.
Yeah, I guess, you know, for us, it is the digital and the physical start intersecting in very many interesting ways. There is issues of privacy, there's issues of data security, there's issues of the kind of horrible, evil potential of artificial intelligence and machine learning. For example, if we look at surveillance, such as produced by the NSO group, it was a big story. NSO is an Israeli cyber weapon, effectively, company that their flagship software, Pegasus, have been used to survey on very many civil society advocates and journalists, etc. We want to see what's the relation between surveillance and what happened to these people that have been surveyed in the real world. So we work with Carmen Aristegui, say, a wonderful investigative journalist in Mexico, and we're seeing the pattern of times that she was targeted by Pegasus, and then we're seeing, her office was broken into. People next to her have been threatened. So it's really the relation between the digital and the physical that actually interests us in this particular way.
Yeah. To me, it is very urgent to pick apart the stuff that is the digital, right? Looking at a machine learning model, understanding how it works, understanding what training sets were used and how those training sets were organized. For me, it really is looking at the specifics of that technology, taking it apart, understanding how it's put together, and understanding what political decisions are made in terms of how it's constructed and what the consequences of that are.
Next question, please. Is there?
So my interest is in the abstract and concrete phenomena of space. And I wonder if you could tell us to what degree you think your architectural forensics could be used to preempt future events.
There is a way of looking into the future is through a strange interpretation of patterns that we recognize in the present or in the near past. So many of our projects produce a certain kind of pattern analysis. Let's say we would look at the way in which migrants crossing water to arrive at safety, to arrive at asylum in Europe, are intercepted, are being left to drown, are being put on, you know, very dangerous dinghies adrift in the Aegean, in other places. And we would start understanding things about the way in which the security, Fortress Europe and its, all its agencies, are actually operating in a particular area. And that information can actually help people make better choices, better informed choices about how to arrive at safety, where they would expect the next kind of interception to be. Of course, you cannot pin down anything in the future with the same level of certainty that you can do in the past. But it's interesting, all sort of ways of, we're speaking about ways of seeing. Mm-hmm. Ways of seeing into the future, yeah, require both data and imagination.
Does anybody else have anything they'd like to bring up?
There's been a surge of interest in the relationship between social media and children and impacts of social media on children. And I wonder if you can talk to me about the role of social media in shaping people's identities, particularly for those of young who are young and young people around the globe.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a Trevor question.
Obviously, our own sense of self is strongly informed by the messages that we are told, by the things that we consume, by the images that we see, you know, reflected towards us. And we're very quickly moving into a world in which the media we consume will be specifically tailored to each of us. The images that we see will be specifically tailored to each of us. And the point of doing this is not to more successfully inform you about what's going on in the world, but the point will be to extract as much value as I possibly can from you. And I think that the cost of this to a culture and to a society is extremely high. You know, you can take the cost of disinformation on one hand, or you can take the cost of creating generations of people that are profoundly insecure, not only because there is very real economic precarity, but also personal insecurity in terms of one's imagination of what one's own self-worth. What do you think?
I think that kind of to borrow one of your concepts that has been most influential, mm-hmm, on me, there is no longer that reality by which one is looking at images, one is looking at a kind of like a static image, mm-hmm, but there is an exchange of gazes. Mm-hmm. You're looking at images on social media, the images are looking back at you. Yeah. The reason the image is looking at you is to study you, extract value for you, to survey on you, mm-hmm, to arrest you, or yeah, even worse. Mm-hmm. So I think that just in kind of in a sort of like as a wrap-up sort of thought, I'd say that when we start interrogating through art and architecture ways of seeing, it's always also ways of being seen. And I think our work is trying to inhabit that kind of multidirectional vision and navigate within it and turn it into a kind of a political statement to, yeah, a certain extent. Mm-hmm.
So, I wanted to ask you if there's any particular objects or pieces of architecture or, you know, moments in history that you come back to over and over again that you're kind of continually mining and seeing from different ways that are productive to you.
So it's almost uncanny. that the entire practice of forensic architecture, that is, using architecture as an investigative technique, but also turning the forensic gaze and looking at the crimes of state, actually sprang out of an analysis of a single object. And that was the first book that I've written on forensics. It was with my colleague, Thomas Keenan. And we wrote a book called Mengele's Skull, The Birth of Forensic Aesthetics. And you go, what's the relation between forensics and aesthetics? For us, it was the reading of the process by which the attempt to identify whether that skeleton that was found under a wrongly marked grave in Brazil was that of notorious Nazi war criminal murderer, doctor of Auschwitz, Josef Mengele. They found the skull. They didn't have DNA yet. And they started reading the skull for traces. In fact, what was interesting is that we discovered that for forensic anthropologists, they were reading bones like they were photographed, exposed to life like a negative is exposed to light, right? So nutrition and wounds and everything else would kind of be inscribed, and the skull itself has emerged as a kind of as a surface of inscription. And it kind of showed, looking at the entire process, made me understand that the forensic process that happens in court is actually a curatorial process. It's a curatorial process.
Yeah, sure.
You need to show an object to an audience. You need to make claim to that object. And the relation of meaning that come would answer maybe one specific question, but would open up bigger history. If I would return the question to you, what would you say?
I think what instantly jumps into mind is a painting in the cave at Lascaux, in a very inaccessible part of the cave. Apparently you have to go down this long shaft. And when you go down this long shaft in this pit, it's a very, very unusual painting that seems to be like a humanoid kind of figure that appears to have the head of a bird, and there's like something that looks like a rhinoceros and some things that might look
things
like
things used to be strange before.
Right, no, exactly. And this is a painting that has been detached from history. You know, any meanings that were ascribed to it at one particular moment or the moment that was created have been lost.
Yeah.
So when we look at that image, the only thing that we have available to us is our imagination. And when you look at the history of interpretations of the image, it's very interesting. They change about every 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, it starts in the 50s, the interpretation, this is the primitive hunter or what have you, and then it goes in the 60s, it turns into an interpretation of this must be some kind of ecstatic drug-induced hallucination or what have you. So it goes year by year. So what's interesting to me is, what is that very strange space between the image that appears to be making a claim, is certainly making a mark and sending it off into the future, you know, like a message in a bottle, but it's in an indecipherable language.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so to me, it's just a very beautiful crystallization of the problem of, and the magic, really, of images.
Yeah. Because there's a moment that when images are made, whether it's a photograph, a digital or physical photograph, or a painting, that things encounter other things. No, I don't know. So a stick encounters stone, or some pigment is, you know, spread over, you know, a particular surface. And they capture the moment of that encounter. The stick and the stone, right? And the magic of images is that that moment of encounter would somehow transform and mean different things, but it means different things because we want to say different things, because at every given period, we have another stake to make. So an image is always a debate. An image is always, to interpret images
is to think about our future, is to debate who we are and where we want to be. There's a quote that you know, that is really curious for me, something that you've said, and I think you quoted somebody else. You said every photograph of environment is a photograph of environmental change. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so that was a young photographer that I know who's helped me on some projects named William Matsuda just said that. He was photographing some work in around Portland, and it really resonated with me because I thought that's correct. Like, every photograph is a photograph of environmental change. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that over the course of my own work. You know, I started out in the early 2000s. I was going out into Nevada in the desert. I was taking these very long distance pictures of military bases. And I'm not sure that you could take those photographs anymore because the fires, right? You know, the really the air in the West is very different now than it used to be. And when you're making images, you know, at these more, you know, at the kind of edge of what's possible to make images at, that becomes very pronounced. That becomes very, very visible. You know, the amount of particulate in the air becomes super visible. The amount of the temperature.
It reminds me that people now do some kind of scientific forensic analysis on painting by Turner.
Yeah.
Right? And you have, you know, you have hundreds of those here at Tate Britain, and each one captures light in a particular way, but they don't only capture light, they capture the pollution of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And the way that the light is refracted, the way that things come out of focus.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because it's not really an analysis of the object, but of the medium. I think I want to kind of like accelerate that process of interpretation, looking, etc. So the battlefield today is a field of images.
Yeah.
Bombs are delivered to target via multiple cameras, and the relation between, you know, camera on a drone, a camera on a rocket, cameras on the ground, body cams on combatants, etc. So we have a field that is photographic. Images are part of the war. Images are war. The images speak to each other continuously, transferring messages that are, you know, instructions, but they're encoded as images.
Yeah.
So a whole hive of images that speak to each other. And I think that that means that images themselves are kind of part of conflict, no? It's like, it's not the meaning of the images, but the images themselves are kind of munitions in a very strange battlefield that happen both on the ground and then happen on our screen and in our social media as they want to draw you in into one camp or the other, right? Do you?
Oh, I completely agree with that. And so you're talking about, for example, how does the targeting computer in a drone work, or a targeting camera? And what it does is takes images, automatically interprets those images, i.e. says, you know, here is a target, there's not a target, here's a combatant, non-combatant, what have you, right? And so that image making is a part of the kill chain, you know, as they call it. And that's really weird, you know, in terms of that's kind of a new thing in the history of images. And that's really interesting to me because, of course, there's a politics of interpretation to that, right? However, that politics of interpretation is hard-coded into the algorithms that are analyzing the software.
Yeah.
And we can see that same logic in things like artificial intelligence very clearly. You know, artificial intelligence systems that will try to look at your face and analyze, are you happy? Are you sad? Can I capitalize on the emotions that I see in your face to try to sell you something? Or in new kinds of cars that have cameras installed in them that watch you driving them in order to transmit information to your insurance company about whether you're distracted or not or what have you. We're going to modulate your insurance rates in real time. I want to ask you, do you think art or images, architecture can tell the truth?
I think truth is a complicated term. I think to say truth is to give an ethical, sometimes political meaning to facts. Mm-hmm. I think facts is something that is produced. I believe in, you know,
verification rather than veritas, which is the origin of the word truth, because verification is an immanent practice. It's a relation between people. It's a relation between different bits of evidence that are kind of brought together, and it allows for a collective intelligence rather than a transcendent, God-given truth. I believe that truth is a battlefield. I believe that images have part in that battlefield, and I believe that the interpretation of images are also themselves part of that kind of war. So this is why images need to offer also resistance, and an interpretation of images need to offer resistance to that field that has infringed upon, that invaded our world, rather than we enter, you know, we left our to go into their kind of field. No, they've entered ours.
Right. And I think that also speaks to the enormous responsibility that I think comes along with being somebody who makes images, and somebody who interprets them.
Yeah.
So I think we can open it up to the audience questions now.
Yeah, you know, you've talked a bit about presenting evidence, and you've talked about, you know, prosecutors being consumers even at exhibitions. To what extent do you see that courts, whether national or international, are adopting your techniques to actually bring people to justice?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question because the legal world is the most absolutely conservative, maybe after art. But every time you take something, a case of us, to court, you have two battles. One is for admissibility, is showing that you can, that, A, we have the expertise to do it. Image practitioners, architects, artists have something to say that and have something to discover that other, perhaps, mode of analysis cannot. And then, only when that is established, you can move to the second stage and prove your case. And we see that the field of evidence, that admissibility, is changing. And every time you allow for open source intelligence or 3D modeling or other forms of reconstruction to be admitted, you open the door a little wider for other people to pass through it. So that is the most important kind of battle that we are engaged with, like allowing people to see and hear things that are presented by, you know, and recorded by civilians on the ground.
So my question would be about the machine learning models, the ones which are particularly involved with AI and deep learning. Regarding these kind of models, it's extremely difficult to create models which actually achieve some stated goals. It's even more harder to avoid these models having accidental causing collateral damages or unintended consequences. Have you had any experience with such kind of problems or using such kind of forensic analysis?
The first thing that you do is you just look at the training set, right? So all the machine learning models are all based on a training set, which is, in the case of vision models, it's thousands or millions, even billions of images that have been labeled in particular ways. And I did a big study with my friend Kate Crawford of what was at the time the most widely used of these training sets for object recognition, which was called ImageNet. ImageNet is something like 14 million images organized into about 20,000 something categories. And you look at it and you realize this is absolutely horrible, because what the people who made the data set did was they basically took a version of the dictionary. They said, let's take all of the nouns out of the dictionary. We're going to assume that a noun is something that can be represented by an image, and then we're going to create a data set of images that correspond to all the nouns. Now, you can see there's a problem. Many, many problems. One problem is that there's certainly nouns like debt that don't look like anything, right? There's also lots of nouns that are incredibly racist, misanthropic, homophobic, misogynistic, what have you. Those are all words, and those words have politics. And when you simply translate language, you know, uncritically into a machine learning system, you're going to reproduce those politics. So in terms of looking at those kinds of harms that are built into a model, you can very simply do that by looking at the training data in many cases. Now, this is something that people like OpenAI have learned from. And with the newer models, the training set is simply the whole internet. They just scrape the whole internet, that becomes the training data for the model. Now, in terms of proving harms by machine learning systems, I don't think that you need to do a forensic analysis of that. You can simply read the business plan of the companies that are developing them, right? And there is a common vision in many of the applications of AI, which is a vision of a society in which human lives and the most intimate parts of human lives are sites of extraction, right? And we can think about what the predictable consequences of that are, i.e., on one hand, amplifying inequality, amplifying precarity on one hand, and then amplifying, you know, some really of the most kind of horrific parts of culture because that produces engagement and therefore value.
I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the extent to which sort of battlefield has entered cultural institutions and educational institutions and the kind of pressure that those spaces are kind of coming under.
Yeah, we had an exhibition, a big exhibition here called Cloud Studies. It was it opened in Manchester, and it closed almost immediately because the museum found that that our language, and this is a language that supports an anti-colonial struggle in Palestine, was very clear about that, was calling things the way they were, was referring to apartheid, to settler colonialism, etc. Were inappropriate or even anti-Semitic, and you know, to be accused as a Jewish person here of anti-Semitism, I found a bit bizarre. But the minute that politics enter into those fields, they become battlefields themselves, and we need to not only fight for the messages that we say, but for the capacity to speak, for the ability to speak and be heard. And this is one thing. Another is that we can never consider the art and cultural domain, the forums of art and culture, to be neutral of politics themselves. And very often we find ourselves investigating the very museum or gallery where we are presenting. And such a case happened at the Whitney, when we were invited to the Whitney Biennale, realizing that one of the funders of the exhibition was actually an arms dealer and investigated the Whitney at the Whitney. So that was a kind of a way to turn the, you know, the kind of the white cube or the black box into not only a space where you can reflect upon politics, you can say what politics mean, but can actually explode outwards and become a political event that has consequences. And that member of the Whitney board had to resign because of many other things, and activists that did fantastic work, but to which we were honored to contribute.
So we have been talking about the images, data, and the social media, and whatever the end user consumes throughout the world. And the whole of internet, I think, is controlled by a few companies who have these intercontinental submarine cables with the data centers all around the world. What do you think is the role of these companies in terms of surveillance, in terms of the control of the data that everyone else is consuming?
Why don't I start and then hand it off to you?
Yeah.
So the promise of the internet was, of course, that it was famously meant to be networks of networks, right? As that evolved, there were certain places where those networks needed to come together. And the things, internet exchanges are an example of that. Undersea cables are other examples of that. And so those became very juicy targets for intelligence agencies. So if you were a military, your intelligence agency, you could try to plant sensors at those choke points, for lack of a better word, and begin to conduct mass surveillance. Now, in parallel to that, you have the rise of the Googles and Amazons of the world, who increasingly are building cloud infrastructures that are similarly concentrated, not necessarily geographically, but in terms of who controls them. And those become sites of surveillance very similar to the kind of surveillance that GCHQ might be doing or NSA might be doing. But the point is a little bit different. The point is to, again, to extract value from that data by any means necessary. The point is that what this adds up to in either case, both in terms of the infrastructure and in terms of the businesses themselves, is almost the exact opposite of what the promise of the internet was. Do you want to add to that, Eyal?
Maybe just a comment on, you know, the kind of the idea that some companies or some state have complete control over something. I don't think any system has complete control over anything. Mm-hmm. I think there are technologies that are dangerous, and that in Trevor and in the practice of forensic architecture, we try to reconstruct, we try to understand these technologies for two purposes. One is how to evade them. In order to evade something, you need to know how it operates, how to camouflage yourself from digital surveillance, mm-hmm. say. And the second is how to turn it around. Every tool of domination can be tool of liberation, mm-hmm. if you know how to do that. And I think that this is why you need people that I think, you know, like you, Trevor, no, that can think creatively about this technology precisely in order to see its weak points. Mm-hmm. Every empire has collapsed. You know, I mean, look at what happened with a, you know, CIA perfect control with the drones we were all scared and obsessed about. But the entire project, the entire occupation, mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, in Iraq, has been destroyed due, mm-hmm. to kind of very much on the ground resistance. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to be wary of that technology, but we need to learn it in order to turn it against itself and understand it. It's imperfect.
I think that's a really good point that you're making, which is that all infrastructures, all built environments have politics built into them, literally built into them. But those can take many forms.
Yeah.
The internet did not need to be the greatest tool of mass surveillance in the history of the world. That was a set of decisions, or yeah. design decisions even.
Yeah.
And so I think, well, on one hand, we're both concerned about these questions of analysis and how can we learn something, but I think we're both similarly concerned with how do we reimagine, yeah. building our environments differently, building different politics into them, not only as a way to care for human life now, but because we know institutions move into the future, how do we try to care for the future as well?